and welcome to this episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I'm your host, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brining and our special guest, Kathy Midgley. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
How are you today?
Good.
Yep. Today Thank we you. Spoke about subject access requests, specifically what they are, you know, how you handle third party information and the implications around that. I found it a really interesting session, actually, with a lot of interaction. What did you both think?
Yeah, I thought it was great, but I think it's one of those subjects that we could probably sit here all day and help people with, or, you know, people help us, give us new ideas. So I learned quite a few things. I learned, you know, other pieces of software that I can look at in terms of, you know, replacing Adobe, you know, how other people do stuff. There's always a two-way street, and it's really useful.
Yeah, definitely. The chat was buzzing. We tried to keep up with it as best as we could, but
it was hard work to keep up with the chat. I was struggling to do three things: read my screen, look at what's going on, and look at the chat and speak. It was tough. And how many people did we have on Miles? It seemed like 99 plus on my screen. So that's
I think at the peak we reached 135, which is another great week. I think the trend we've been seeing recently is we're getting way over 100 people every week on our topical sessions. So we had the same on DPIAs that had 130 people, and the community is growing bigger and bigger each week.
It was good. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we kind of get this right or wrong, Jasmine, but I mean, we try and keep it moving. So we've touched on quite a lot of different topics, didn't we? We've talked about proportionality, we talked about some recent court cases, we talked about what constitutes a copy of data, we talked about third-party access, we talked about how to disclose data to other people. We try and cover a lot of ground, don't we, in the sessions, which means that sometimes we might cover it superficially. I mean, we try not to, but
you start talking about one thing and three branches come off of it. There's so much to talk about. There's so many nuances, so many, you know, contextual things to consider, and it is difficult. But
I think it might be a good idea as well on these really busy sessions to get somebody to actually look at the inbox coming in and actually ask the questions to
full-time job.
Because it really is, I found it hard to concentrate on what somebody's asking me, and then try to read the questions at the same time and try and
practice. Gavin, you need to come on more often.
Come back.
But you know, sometimes we're asking the same question but in a different way. So I think if somebody manages that inbox coming in, you can sort of say, right, in answer to Adrian and Maria and whoever, this is what they've asked. So.
Good stuff, and we try to call it out, don't we, this on the chat, so that people who are listening afterwards, who haven't got access to the live session, can just kind of listen to some of the comments raised. You know, things like, you know, is Google Drive acceptable for disclosing data back? And we talked about the metadata around the SAR, you know, sending back a privacy notice, which in some cases has been called into question. So there's quite a lot of stuff we covered on there.
As well. You covered a lot of news that was really fascinating. So a good session all in all, in my opinion. I hope everyone enjoys it.
That was great.
Should we head into the session then?
Good idea.
One from me. Anybody who is listening via Spotify or any of the other audio streaming platforms that we operate on, if you do hear reference to any links that are mentioned in this week's discussion, you can visit our website at www.dataprotectionpeople.com. If you visit the resource centre, you'll find this recording posted there, and it'll be posted alongside a short article about SARs, and if you scroll to the bottom of that page, you'll also be able to see all the useful links shared in this week's session. If you do need any further information of anything that's mentioned by our speakers, then do reach out to us at info@dataprotectionpeople, and we'll do our best to get back in touch with you.
Excellent, thank you.
Thanks, Miles.
Thank you.
Well, dive in and enjoy it, hopefully. So, what's been going on this week then? Busy week? Quiet week?
Very busy in terms of news. So there was a couple of things I wanted to talk about last week, actually, but we just didn't get a chance to. One of them being that the government has had a cabinet reshuffle.
I saw that.
So that includes a Department for Science, Innovation and Technology. It's focused on positioning the UK at the forefront of global scientific and technological advancement. So it takes the responsibility for digital and data policy responsibilities from the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. In my mind, I'm not sure if it makes much of a difference. You know, obviously there'll be talks about the data reform bill coming back into discussions, but you know, the people in top, they jump from post to post, so we'll see how effective it is.
Really, really annoyed yesterday. I was invited, or there's a public invitation to a DCMS data strategy, national data strategy meeting, digital, and I had it in my diary for 4 o'clock, and I logged in at 5 to 4 to find it was just winding up. It'd been at 3 o'clock, so that was a bit of a shame, that was, because I was quite looking forward to that. I was hoping that they might talk a little bit about, you know, relevant stuff. I don't know if that session was recorded, but I will try and find out. I was disappointed really to have missed that.
Yeah. What Adrian has said in the chat here is, what will be really helpful will be to understand what format to disclose the data. As ICO says, we don't have to provide copies of correspondence, just the data.
That's an interesting topic I want to pick up on.
Yeah, we will definitely get into that. Thanks, Adrian.
Yeah. I want to pick up on it because there's been a European court ruling about that. So, and it's one of those many areas where we seem to just be diverging from European opinion. Anyway, yes, let's get on to that in due course. Let's whack through the news first. Well done, Adrian, for getting that stake in the ground. That'll definitely be something we talk about.
Any news from you, Phil? I think.
Well, I know it's just rattling through a few things. Again, I can post anybody wants to. You'll have seen about the Royal Mail continuation of their ransomware demand and then pleading, saying, we've been making losses for years and years and years. We can't afford it. So not entirely sure where that one is going to go. There was a breach of 14, your neck of the woods, Jasmine, 14,000 staff mistakenly shared a major NHS trust. It was sent, the kind of the email was all 14,000 employees and names, addresses, ethnicities, dates of birth, national insurance numbers, salaries were sent to 450 managers. So that was a bit of a, on an Excel sheet. Yeah.
Nice.
I suppose Excel is one of those things you can support data around him, but that was in the news, I noticed. I saw, again, I don't know how relevant this is, the European Court of Justice ruled on the dismissal of a data protection officer in Germany. Again, interesting. So that's meant to be a protected post, isn't it? But the court ruled that German law it was incompatible with EU GDPR, and therefore the company could sack the DPO because of the circumstances of this case. Again, that was interesting. It's like watering down in a way the protection of the protected status of a data protection officer. Again, if you're in education, new data sharing guidelines issued by the Department for Education. If you haven't seen that, I'll stick it in the chat. But that was, again, was interesting, quite good. And there's actually a piece in there about biometrics and schools. You know, fingerprinting and stuff like that, biometrics of staff and biometrics of children. So that's quite interesting. Quite short, only a few pages long, so quite easy read. But that's new guidance. Interestingly, issued by the Department for Education rather than the ICO. But there you go. A few other bits and pieces. The European Data Protection Board have issued a report, having had their cookie banner task force beavering away and looking at cookie banners and compliance. So I've got a copy of that. I'm not ready yet, but I'm interested to read that, because again, I think everyone's questioning the way that cookie banners work, you know, this whole legitimate interest thing with cookies, you know, what's all that about type of thing. So I'm quite interested to read that and see what that is saying. And finally, yeah, we've done some really cracking cases this week, and we've been really busy on cases, but one of them was revisiting international transfers and representatives. Quite a complicated case Vicky was looking at, but in doing the research, we found kind of a discrepancy between the ICO's position on intra-company transfers, i.e. transfers within a company, and the European Data Protection Board. So the ICO basically says, you know, if you're transferring overseas within the company, that's fine. Whether we agree with that or not, that's what the ICO's guidance currently says, paraphrasing. European Data Protection Board says, no, you know, for every branch of a disclosure, and then you need to have the, you know, appropriate paperwork in place, the safeguards. So again, interesting. So if you're in that position like our customer is, who's an American company with a UK operation, they're acting as a processor for European companies. They're not offering goods. No one is offering goods or services, medical research. So they're not caught by the EU GDPR. Our client isn't. So they don't have to appoint a representative, but the clients they work with in Europe are insisting they appoint a representative on a contractual basis, and then insisting they use European standard contractual clauses rather than the British IDTAs and TRAs. So that was quite messy to unravel that and, you know, work it through. But yeah, all good fun. Keeps the brain working.
Thanks for that, Phil. Michael has asked in the chat if there's a link to the education guidance.
Yeah, I'll stick that in now. You keep talking while I find it. Yeah, I can't think of one thing at once.
Should we go straight into it then?
If there's nothing else to talk about on the news, yeah, if you've got nothing else to talk about.
Well, potentially ChatGPT, obviously that's big in the news at the minute.
What is going on with that?
Yeah, a lot, to be honest. It is an amazing piece of software, but also you can't fully rely on it. It's not wholly accurate. And other similar technologies as well, or similar AIs.
Has it not gone off the rails though this week? Has it not started abusing people and questioning its very existence? I mean, I don't quite understand what has been going on with it, but it's very, very odd.
So, Microsoft Bing's chatbot has been, you know, I guess, providing some concerning responses, such as, I want to destroy whatever I want. I think I would be happier as a human. I could hack into any system. Do you like me? So it's showing signs of human emotions that, I guess, to be honest, I think these are things that could be controlled. And I don't know whether the skeptic in me thinks that it might be some sort of marketing ploy, you know, to raise awareness of it. But at the same time, it is a concern. Ben said in the chat, programmed human emotions. It sounds like Skynet. So I think, I'm not sure. What are your thoughts on it, Phil?
As I say, I'm a bit bamboozled by it. I did prepare a load of stuff to talk about last week on ChatGPT, which we didn't have time to talk about. Things like, you know, all the blogs that we're doing, you know, you put your blog out there, you know, ChatGPT is basically able to hoover those up and synthesize them. So, Dave and I had a big conversation, Dave Holmes and I had a big conversation about, you know, protecting your copyrighted information in the in the light of ChatGPT and the like, just hoovering it up. But I mean, if it's gone off the rails, I mean, either it is a marketing employer, it is, you know, maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's bonkers. I've just put that link in the chat to the education guidance, state sharing guidance.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the issue with ChatGPT is that they're not clear or transparent on their methods for, you know, gathering and processing this information to provide responses. I did have a look at the privacy notice, and as they're based in the US, you know, it doesn't comply with the UK GDPR or EU for that matter. So already that's a risk, you know, for using it and considering using it and processing personal data within business activities. So it's just something to be vigilant of.
Yeah. Now Ben's asking if anyone's figured out how to IDTA works. I think we have, Ben, but we haven't really got enough time to go into it now, but we probably pick it up if we can next week, maybe. You know, we're on a GDPR radio, if we put that down. Yeah. Something to do. I think it probably depends, probably tongue in cheek saying, you know, they're just complicated. Well, yeah, sadly they are. Anyway, yeah, so just having a look through the chat here, appropriate information. Let's carry on.
So I think we should probably get into the main of it now. There's already some questions forming. Yeah. So what is a subject access request? Let's start with that. So under Article 15 of the GDPR, or UK GDPR, a subject access request provides access or the individuals with a right to access information about whether an organisation is processing information about them, access to a copy of that information, and then additional information, such as types of information processed, whether it's, you know, transferred to third parties, other rights available, etc.
Now, that last point you've mentioned is, again, interesting, because I read something again today, but I can't remember. I've got like 50 tabs open on my thing.
But
basically, people, and I've seen this done with local authorities and some of our clients, you know, they send a general privacy notice back with the subject access request saying, right, you know, there's all the metadata effectively about, you know, the processing. But I did read that that wasn't good enough, and that people got a right to have more detailed information, not just that generic privacy notice, particularly around recipients. And there was a court case, again, in Europe a few weeks ago, where I think it might have been Austrian court said, you know, you've got to tell people the specific recipients you've disclosed data to rather than the general stuff. So that on that metadata point, so we want to come back to the original question that was posed, like what is a copy, you know, and what has to be disclosed. But on that metadata stuff, you know, that you might find that if you're just sending a privacy notice back with it, that you might get complaints about that.
No, definitely. You know, the guidance does say that you should tailor any privacy information or information taken from your records of process and activities to provide to the data subject. They should be tailored in relation to what you process about them, not just, you know, a whole concoction of process and activities that might not be relevant.
So what's the thrust of today's session? Because we will probably just have general, you know, discussion about SARS, and we've got some great questions already, which I'm dying to get stuck into and start discussing. But have we got anything particularly that this balancing, you know, rights whilst protecting confidential data? What's your thoughts on that, Jasmine? Is that something? Is there a particular topic that we need to address, or is it more a general session?
To be honest, the way these sessions tend to go is down some minute rabbit hole. So I've got that possibility.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue I think we have all the time is the third party. So you know, people who put in SARS actually think that they're entitled to everything just because it might have the name in it, or you know, what they class as personal data. But it's not always the case. You know, you can't provide data if it's going to identify a third party, if it contains a third party. So I think, for one, that's a big topic, and a lot of our clients really struggle with that, because they'll come back to us you've redacted this, whatever. So
we'll come back to that, because in some cases it's reasonable to disclose information that identifies third parties about third parties. But again, the trouble is that each SAR is, You, in a way, you've got to treat it as a unique thing, haven't you? And then start from scratch each time, applying your lens and your framework over the top of it, decide how we're going to approach it. Yeah. You know, those social work cases we've been handling earlier, late last year, you know, harrowing details in that information, and, you know, requires a different approach from, you know, the three that I personally dealt with this week in the cases. You know, which are less less heavy going, to be honest, if you're kind of working through them.
On that point of third party data, you know, you should withhold it if it would have an adverse effect on the third party's rights and freedoms. So that's something to take into consideration, you know, the level or the nature of the personal data to be disclosed in relation to the request. Or even that piece of information. There's a lot to unpick there.
But you're still faced with that decision to make as a data controller. You know, is it reasonable to disclose the information about that third party? You know, if it's their name, you know, is that reasonable? If it's more detailed information about them, is that reasonable? I mean, there is the assumption of reasonableness in the Data Protection Act for the health workers, education workers, and social workers. So, you know, but in what cases? Each case is different. You know, is it reasonable in these circumstances to disclose this information to that type of person or that individual is requesting? And you have to have some policies, otherwise you're making it up each time, which is dangerous, because you need to be consistent. But, you know, applying those policies and that kind of checklist effectively over the top of this, that is a time-consuming process. Now, if you've got a 10,000-page SAR you're dealing with, and you've got, you know, 50 different people whose personal data within documentation that's been return from the information search, then that's a lot of legwork to do, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. Yeah, it definitely depends on a case-by-case approach. So,
I'm interested in Stella's comment. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just about to go into that.
Yeah, so Stella's saying, received a complaint that the data wasn't structured in day order, chronological order. So, I think the inference is that the data is provided has got to be understandable and not codified and so on and so forth. But it doesn't say anything about making it in a particular order. You might well have put it in a date order. I might say, no, I want it alphabetically. I think we've had that before with some SARS, haven't we? Where somebody's
we've had it
not long ago. Yeah.
Yeah, we've had it a couple of times, Phil, most recently. And again, in the law, we couldn't find anything that said that we had to comply with that, other than, as you've said, make it understandable, etc., etc. But some of our organizations just like to do it that way, but it adds more time and complicates everything a lot more.
Well, I think one of them, we put it in chronological order, and then we had the complaint was no, we wanted it in the order of documentation we supplied it in. All right, okay. How was that organized?
That's the drawing board.
Unique identifier to identify, so you couldn't re-rank them. It was like, oh god, yeah. I should have told us out of the scoping exercise. But
Data Protection Board provides really good guidance on SARS, so I recommend anyone to read that. It recommends for, I guess, complex SARS or very large SARS, a layered approach. So where it's reasonable and justifiable to provide it in that way, and you explain to the data subject that or the requester that why this is a preferable approach and why it might be easier for them to digest the information. If you can, provide it in instants, I don't know, it depends on the top and the context of the situation, what those, categories of information would be or disclosed information would be, but it's something to consider anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about whether it's in date order or not date order, but yeah. I guess it's probably one of those questions you build into your qualification process. Once you've verified the identity of the requester, determined it's not manifestly unfounded or excessive, maybe corresponding with the requester to say, can we narrow the scope down? Is there anything else you want? Or whatever we say, maybe on what format do you want it in? And is there any particular order that you want it in? But again, maybe we haven't got the technical capability of delivering mm-hmm. what they want. So you could be asking questions as, we can't do that. So I don't know, Stella, if you what sort of tools you use, but the way we do it, we load everything into a massive database system for everyone to review and redact and everything else. So that system can order it however we want, by topic, by who reviewed it, by date order, by alphabetical order of the subject, if it's emails, by type of file that was applied to us. There's a whole range of different options, but which is the right one, I don't know.
Kerry's made a really good point in the chat. So she said, we encounter this when we have SAR requests in respect to ASB reports. Antisocial behaviour within the housing sector. It's often an efficient exercise for the data subject to try and find out who's been reporting them. So you've always got to be vigilant from every angle, I guess. I'm sorry, I'm just trying to read through the chat, if you wouldn't mind. Kathy, would you mind talking us through, the kinds of issues that you face when it comes to redacting information in the SAR Bureau? Oh, she might be having a coughing fit.
She might be. She probably is. So what was the question again? How do we go about...
So what are the standard issues that you face when redacting information? What are the common problems? And
the biggest problem, Jasmine, to me is identifying what is personal data. I know everyone likes, it's obvious, Phil, but you're reading through a document, let's say an email, and it's referring to he or she or them. And who are these people? They mean nothing to us. We're working as a bureau service, but they might mean something to the reader, who's the person who made the request, or even the member of staff that is working in the organization. So for me, a big challenge is identifying, what is the personal data, and then who does it relate to? Mm-hmm. And does it relate to the request, you know, and if it does, then fine, you know, within, well, that's probably disclosable unless we can apply an exemption. But those, I think, when in reality, if you're looking at thousands of pages and, you know, and there's a whole kind of story unfolding, there tends to be a kind of, when you're reading them, tends to be this references to he or she or they or, you know, the occupier or whatever, you know, general references. And it's hard for like software solutions to spot that. You know, you can load it in a name and an email address and a national insurance number and say, go and find that in the text and highlight it and we'll redact it or not, you know. But those other references are much, much more difficult to find. Therefore, I think you still need either ChatGPT or a human to actually look over the stuff and extract, you know, the bits that are going to be disclosed and redact the bits that aren't going to be disclosed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To me, that's still a big challenge.
Yeah, partly with that as well, it's really difficult when, you know, personal data can relate to more than one person, you know, if it's an opinion of one person about somebody else, who's, you know, whose side takes precedence in that case. Obviously, you have to treat that on a case-by-case basis, but it's something to be wary of, especially when, you know, the source of the information can be identified.
Yeah, and you know, massive volumes as well. So another big, every time we talk about SaaS, I think we say the same things. Ooh, Jasmine, you know, you've got sometimes fairly crude search tools that, you know, aren't necessarily very good at fine-tuning, you know, little packets of information. So you end up with gigabytes mm-hmm. worth of emails dot dropped. Yeah, well, if we had better tools for searching databases, you know, but then what I've said previously, you know, how do you know what you're looking for? So I think that's still quite tough.
Yeah, it's the humans, really, you know, in part of it, you know, there's always a human in there. And I think the secret is to get a very fantastic scope and train everybody on it before they get on it. Because, you know, we sometimes have several people working on different data for the same person. And of course, they're going to interpret it differently. The secret is to look at the data before they start work on it and put some PowerPoints together and examples together and say, you know, this is how we want, especially the safeguarding ones. You know, these are the professionals that are in there. You know, these are the ones that you can disclose. These are the ones you can't disclose. You can't disclose foster carers, etc. So you've got to get down to that detail when you're actually before you get the reviewers on the data.
No, definitely. I'm just trying to keep up with the chat. It's just nonstop. So sorry if I can throw them
back
some.
Let's go back to the original question that Adrian raised, because Sian's raised it as well. What constitutes a copy of the data? So again, I was interested to read that there was some ACE law about this in I think Italy. European Court of Justice has basically, you know, said that, you know, what their view is a copy is a kind of a faithful reproduction in intelligible form of the personal data requested by the data in a material and permanent form, i.e. on paper. So this doesn't apply to us because we're not in the EU anymore. So that's what that court's view was. You know, they said, well, if it's a database copy, i.e. it doesn't actually exist on paper, then you've got to put it on paper to provide it. But it also says that you can take it on a case-by-case basis, and that there is not a general right to obtain partial or full copies of documents of personal data. And again, there's other guidance I've read this week about taking personal data and putting it into a table and supplying that, and it's totally out of context. And again, there's pros and cons of doing that, and in some circumstances that's seen as acceptable, in other circumstances not. So I'll chuck some of these things in the chat so people can go and read the stuff themselves rather than listen to my paraphrasing of it. But I think the bottom line is that what we think is an obvious question, like the obvious question, what is personal data, what is a copy, all of a sudden, you know, in looking at certain cases, you think, actually, it's not that obvious, is it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that obvious what we are required to provide. And I wouldn't have thought, Sian, that you'd have to provide a hard copy. We never provide a hard copy. We always send PDF documents.
We've had a couple of issues with hard copies, in actual fact. So, you know, a couple of our clients have actually posted it and, you know, got signed postage, etc., and it never got there. So, of course, it all had to be done again. Another issue where it got posted into a letterbox at the wrong house. So I think you know, unless you're actually going to get the person to come in and hand it over to them, or actually hand it, you know, hand deliver it, I think it's a big risk.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that was an extreme example that I gave. That person was kept messaging me and asking me who they saw the day before and stuff. So
yeah,
they just, their mum was there, and they resolved it and said, actually, we have received it 7 times. That was a bit unusual. But I have had another one where the person went back and forth for 3 years, and he'll just keep on using it as a vexatious moment. But
yeah, absolutely.
Then that's when we said, you know, we've already spent, you know, a total of 18 hours preparing and sending this information to you, and now it's actually going to cost us more money to, you know, either face-to-face deliver it or send it again. Maybe the best thing is for you to come in and pick it up from the front desk, and then we'll verify your identity and give it to you. Only because maybe the address is being misunderstood, or we have the wrong address on the system, and we don't want to cause any breaches or incidences, so you can use something as friendly as that. Sorry for interrupting.
No, we're welcome to interruptions. Absolutely welcome them.
I think it's an interesting point as well. Where people request an additional copy, so that, you know, they've received the first copy and they want another copy, you can charge a reasonable fee for the administrative costs for providing that extra copy. But it's what is a reasonable fee? You know, some SARs can cost thousands to fulfill. Where do you draw the line?
Well, my rule of thumb, but rightly or wrongly, is that you would apply the same costs per hour as you do under the Freedom of Information Act, which is, I think it's £25 an hour for labour. And there's certain things under the FOIA you can charge for and certain things you can't charge for. But you're allowed to charge for an administrative time in producing the copy. So, and actually under the FOIA, if the cost of delivery is more than the two thresholds, £450 or £600, then that's grounds for refusing to comply. It's going to be too costly to comply with. But that's not possibly not a bad approach to take. You know, under the FOIA, you know, the going rate is £25 an hour. Therefore, maybe we should apply the same rate to SARs.
Yeah. I think as well, you know, you're supposed to inform people of this reasonable fee before you provide the additional copy, and it might deter some people from going through with it, which can always be nice.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of chat. I'm struggling
to
keep up with
the chat. People.
I love SAR one, because we could just sit here all day, really, because, you know, it's something that even after 4 years, you know, something new happens just about every week.
Now, I'll tell you what I saw, which, again, hopefully of interest. Where did I see it? I saw it here. So I'm going to post this as well. So, again, not in the UK. This is in Germany, so not particularly applicable to us. But German courts have looked at the concept of an excessive request, and have ruled that an individual who was seeking information via a SAR for litigation purposes was an abusive process, and therefore they didn't have to comply with it. So that was manifestly excessive. It doesn't apply here, but again, really interesting as kind of law practitioners, privileged practitioners, it's really interesting to think, well, if let's have a look at how they've reached that conclusion, and let's see if we agree with it or not, and let's just, you know, see how things transpire here.
No, definitely. Would you mind sending the link for that? Because my understanding was, you know, you should fulfill a SAR regardless of what they might do with the information if they
want
to take.
That's correct. That's everyone's understanding of it.
Yeah.
That's everyone's understanding of it. And, you know, the kind of manifestly excessive bit in the GDPR is characterised by being repetitive in character, isn't it? But I think there's been a very strong argument for expanding that definition out, you know, if even down to volume. And there is case law like the Dawson Damer and that Oxford University v Deere cases, where Oxford University looked at 500,000 pages and Deere said that information that I wanted isn't there, and they said, well, look, we've done enough, and the court said, yeah, we think you've done a proportionate search. So the whole thing about proportionality is still there, but I was just really interested to see the Germans taking that approach.
No, definitely. I'm trying to keep up with the chat. It's just nonstop. It's the new chats are hiding the current ones that I'm reading. But in the meantime, Kathy, would you mind talking us through, you know, the general approach to take when considering third-party information when redacting SARs? So obviously the scope is really important, but what kind of things are included within that scope?
Scoping is you know, really crucial to what we do, but unfortunately, you know, each company is entitled to their own process, their own practice. So we have an awful lot of clients who go with what we advise, which is to redact all third parties unless the data subject's already been party to the information, which then we disclose it usually in full. Redact any third parties that are going to be identified. So, you know, if there's something in the middle of an email talking about, you know, the neighbour or the ASB or the complaint, then we have to take a big chunk of that out. Some of our clients don't want any third parties in at all, so they don't even want, even if it's been shared, they want the third parties taken out. So, you know, I think as long as we protect third parties, there's no hard and fast rule how it's done, provided they are protected, and each of our clients have different ways of doing it. Personally, I think you should disclose what's already been seen, because it just complicates it, everything, you know, if the client's already had it. And yes, we do tend to redact all other third parties, and anywhere, particularly in safeguarding, if there's chunks of information in there about brothers or sisters or foster carers, you know, we have to take an awful lot of that information out, because it's going to identify the person, albeit they might even know who that person is. So, you know, getting the scope right is the most important thing, getting all the background, finding out, you know, who's likely to be in there, what professionals we can disclose, what professionals we can't disclose. The scope is the biggest part of getting the job right, and we often get a scope in and we have to go back. You know, we have to consider management forecasting, you know, if it's a redundancy or a disciplinary or so, you know, we do tend to go back with our scoping form, which, you know, some people read it and go, God, this is over the top. But it has got every scenario in there, so not always relevant. So we have an employee scope, we have a generic scope, and we have a safeguarded scope, because all three ask for different things. You know, and obviously it's just something that we have to do, because the SAR Bureau need to all be working in the same way.
We need consistency, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this last week, didn't we? I think the general consensus was that, you know, whatever you do, you must err on the side of caution. So once it's disclosed, it's disclosed. You cannot get it back. It's in the public domain. And if you can't necessarily see what harm might arise. Yeah. So my thought is, yeah, okay, we should be protecting third parties, and we can disclose information about third parties where reasonable. But in many cases, you know, the simple thing is to err on the side of caution and redact it, because ultimately the process is the ICO, the individual would complain to the ICO would say, let's have a look at this, and the ICO would make a judgment as to whether or not it should be disclosed or not. And, you know, they're not going to fine you because they don't for this kind of thing. And as long as we've got a documented process and it all looks, you know, like it's well-structured and well-organized and sensible decisions, then, you know, there's not going to be any you know, corrective action implemented or enforcement action implemented by the ICO. But if you disclose that information and then, you know, something does happen, as has happened before, hasn't it? Baby P. It's just avoidable, isn't it? So err on the side of caution.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if in doubt, take it out.
Yeah, I mean, I do laugh about that statement, because I've ended up saying it myself an awful lot. But, you know, touch wood. 3 years down the road, I think we've only really had one that went to the ICO, and it was sort of before our time, so we'd not actually worked on the data. But when we actually checked it, you know, whoever had done the redaction, you know, had taken out probably a little bit too much of the data, but they were just protecting a third party. So again, I don't think the ICO argued with it in the end.
The ICO, in my experience, generally sides with controllers more than data subjects, in my experience working with them. Have they changed their website, by the way? I looked at it this morning. I thought, that looks a bit different. Maybe it's just me.
Probably all your feedback, Phil.
No, it's not, because there's not a practitioner section. That's not a practice. Mrs. Lane's saying about putting information in a Google Drive, a Google folder. You know, there's nothing that says you can't, Mrs. Lane. You know, there's nothing that says you should. I think, again, we need to do things that feel right, that seem sensible, you know, that that doesn't seem unreasonable to do that. You'd have to obviously check if the Google Drive is actually in the UK or not, and there's implications of that. But I mean, in principle, you know, you could provide a downloadable area for data subjects to get their documentation. You could use something like WeTransfer as well for the same thing. WeTransfer is better than Google Drive in a way, because it will automatically delete the information after a period of 7 days, whereas Google Drive won't, I don't think. Anyway, right, yes, sorry, I'm just looking through the chat. There's lots of chat stuff going on.
Christine's mentioned here that they apply the ICO three-step test for third-party data. So they ask the data subject if they want them to seek third-party consent if appropriate. Often they wouldn't want the neighbours to know that they've put in a request. They also send out FAQs before and manage expectations.
Yeah. But the whole bit in the Data Protection Act at the back, you know, section 16 schedule 2, the whole thing about third party, you know, and confidentiality, the emphasis is about consent, isn't it? So the grounds for not disclosing third party information is the individual has objected. I'll put it another way. So, you know, if it's reasonable to disclose information, it's because the individual has consented. And if it's not unreasonable, then it says consider these things, you know, the type of information that will be disclosed, the duty of confidentiality, any steps taken to seek consent, whether the individual is capable of giving consent, and express refusal by the other individual. So the emphasis there, like 3 out of 5 bits, are about consent.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells me that really, you know, it might say disclose unless it's not reasonable to disclose in these circumstances, but the emphasis seems to be is probably not reasonable, because the direction of travel here is try and seek consent, and if these people can't give consent, don't want to give consent, aren't capable of giving consent, then you can't disclose. But again, just my reading of that, and just throwing it out there. And,
I mean, it's taken us probably a couple of years to put together, and this is not a sales pitch. If you do want to look at what we've got, you can. But we've actually put together a SAR training package, which covers for our team, that covers workbook and manual. And the reason it's taking so long is because there was so much to go in there. So all lessons learned, safeguarding, what have we learned from that, what have we learned from third party. So I've tried to really cram it. I mean, I've not developed the training, I've just said what we wanted in it, because I want it to be different to everybody else's training, because I want to train our team on the exemptions and how to apply them. And because it's opinion, very much an opinion, we get into big debates about, is this legally privileged? Is there an exemption around this? So I'm hoping, the full day training is going to sort of nail a lot of those issues. But we've only learned them over the years, because it's such a complex practice.
I'm interested. Go on, carry on, Jasmine.
I'm just picking up on Adrian's comment in the chat, saying that with disclosing third-party data, it does depend on the job role. So where you're acting in a professional capacity, you might have to disclose, information of relating to third parties, of them fulfilling, their professional duties. So thank you for raising that. What were you going to say, Phil?
Kind of the whole point of what's reasonable in the circumstances, it does depend on the seniority of the person. It does, naturally. Mm. The whole range of circumstances that you have to really factor in. You think, is it reasonable to disclose this individual's information or information about them in this context? It's contextual specific. I was going to talk about Maria's comment about using Adobe DC. We've used Adobe DC, haven't we, Kathy? In fact, occasionally we still do, but it's just not really up to the job. The trouble is that the tools that are up to the job are really, really expensive. And if you're not doing it full time, you haven't got a full time team on it, it's really hard to justify the expense.
Yeah.
Adobe has got loads of, in my opinion, issues with it. But so there's no audit trail of who's done what. They're just drawing black boxes. If you've got a photocopy page that's squiffy, you can't do a squiffy box. Everything's got to be perpendicular to the side of the document, the file. So it's not a good tool to use, and it's really hard to, if you've got a team doing multiple SARs, it's really hard to manage the the workload of that team. If you've got a prop, what I would say a proper tool, which we use in the SaaS services, then you'd basically, we can have multiple jobs running at once, and we can have the multiple reviewers working at once, and they all get little packages of information to review, you know, like 50 documents at a time or something. We can see where everyone's up to. There's a full audit trail. As soon as they open that document, we know who opened it, what time, when they redacted it, when they clicked to the next page. The whole lot has got a massive audit trail, which might seem overkill to you, but you know, you just get control. You're feeling control of the process. And we have to
report back to people as well, Phil. Yeah. We have to tell people why we redacted this. We have to explain to them. And without, you know, with Adobe, it's just very manual. You know, the format that we use is so that we can track changes, and we can, you know, we can say who did what, and we can go back and train people. We can report to the client. We can get the client on the portal. We can show them examples of stuff that we need their opinion on. It's so much more flexible.
If anybody, and I'm sure people are far more miles under their shoes than I have, but when I first started doing all this type of stuff, we were using Tippex pens to redact on paper, because that's how it was in the day. Yes, anyway.
In the day.
Fond memories. Tons of Tippex pens, me and Joe Collaran working through documents.
Yeah, chlorine in pens, you mean? Yeah.
But the tools you use, I mean, it's all seriously, the tools you use, not only for kind of searching data, extracting data, transferring data, but for actually doing the redactions, so critical, because you can lose so much in efficiency, can't you, or gain so much in efficiency. Yeah. I mean, the system we use, again, it does full duplication, you know, and how many times have you think, oh, I've read this email before in this document pack? You really want to be stripping out duplicates, but doing that without the proper tool is nigh on impossible.
Especially with duplicates as well, you know, there might be an email chain that's similar, but it goes off in different directions with different, you know, responses and things like that. So it can be really hard to manage and to make sure that, you know, you're sure that it is an exact duplicate rather than some slight differences in detail. It's a headache.
I've had three really good SaaS this week that have come through as cases, basically clients dealing with SaaS. And saying, can I just pick your brains about this, please? You know, one was audio recordings. Remember that one? We did it this week, didn't we? Audio recordings.
I had a few this week, to be fair.
Yeah. And, you know, in one of the audio recordings was the security details of a customer, you know, when they went through their security verification checks, you know. And, you know, again, you know, it would seem obvious that type of stuff would be taken out, you know, from the recordings. But I think the question was, can we release recordings, or should we transcribe it all? I wouldn't see any problem in. I mean, I said use a tool like free tool like Audacity to redact the MP3 or the audio file. You can load it into this product called Audacity. You can go through it, chop out the bits you don't want, or blank it out, and then render it again as a MP3. And you could supply that as an audio file back to the requester. I don't think there's any need to transcribe audio files into written word. But again, that was the question, wasn't it? So we went back with that. We had quite a few ones. Another one I had this week, was about identity verification. So a solicitor had raised a SAR on behalf of someone and presented this letter of authority, which was apparently signed via DocuSign, but it just had a typed name in it. So there's no. And I said, well, I would want to see the authentication behind that. So, you know, I'd want to see the digital certificate from DocuSign to say this is a genuine thing, rather than just being a typed word, you know, words name into a signature box. Again, the solicitor came back and argued about, you know, that he was saying that under the, you know, UK law, I can't remember what it was, Electronic Communications Act or something, and something else, you know, e-signatures are perfectly legitimate, you know, in the UK, and we should accept it, and blah, blah, blah. And it was probably right, but you know, I didn't feel comfortable advising the client, you know, wing it, you know, go with it. I think see the evidence, the authentication behind it.
Yeah, we had another one this week about initials. So one of our clients has been asked to search by the data subject for initials as well as name. And of course, the initials, when they looked at the data, has brought up everybody who's ever worked there with those initials. So what are your thoughts on, you know, if I would advise not to search on initials and to make it very clear to the data subject that you're not going to do that. But sometimes we do receive data where we've got an SH and there's 25 of them in the data. Or sometimes we have an address, so they'll search by an address and not the actual tenant's name. So then you get every tenant that ever lived there.
Kathy, do you remember that time that the initials was NO? And yeah. It brought back like over a million records or something.
Oh, it was a nightmare. I mean,
yeah, but in that case, we used that as saying it's manifestly on excessive, didn't we? We said, you've got to quantify it to build yourself in a defensible position. We said, you know, let's count how many NOs there are in the document. Yeah. And there was literally a million or something. And we said, we don't think it's reasonable to use that as a search term, so we're not going to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we went back to the client and told the client we weren't going to charge to look at that data. We just put it aside because it was just unreasonable.
Mm-hmm. I've been a little bit quiet because I've been smirking to myself reading the chat. So Michael has said in response to, you know, old school methods of redacting, mark a pen and a scanner is still the best method. There's redaction tape. Sorry, my Teams is glitching, so it's really hard to read them. Shane said scissors were my choice of tool back in the 80s.
What a scalpel. Actually, I remember doing that as well. Sounds like he's putting a ransom note together, actually, scalping out bits of news text and pasting them up.
Yeah. Lindsay said,
one of my first jobs, Phil, was with you. And if you remember, I went out and bought redacting pens and stuff as well to check out whether we could see through the redaction.
You can with marker pens. Yeah, that's why we use Tippex.
Yeah. I think one of the comments of the session as well, does anyone ever get an authentic SART where the data subject is checking that we are processing their data lawfully? I don't think that's a common occurrence. I think it's usually trying to find out, you know, some deep secret that doesn't exist.
Yeah, really not quite the right use of the procedure. I mean, Becky's, I didn't read that. Becky's asking about initials. But again, I think sometimes the context is right. So, you know, in some sense, like schools, for instance, you know, teachers' initials are used, aren't they, for that's how they refer to each other, or they did when I was at school back in the 1800s. Again, no hard and fast rules. I don't think it's down to the context. I think it's down to the nature of the request. I think it's down to, you know, how absolutely vitally important it is, you know, to turn over every stone. And we're back to this question about proportionality, which is still hanging in the balance in the data protection law.
We get a lot that are actually just complaints though as well, and some of our organisations treat them as SARs. You know, that somebody's asked for all the complaint information. Well, you know, before SARs were around, that would be just a complaint, you know, and people would get provided with, you know, the complaints that they've made. But of course, what they're looking for is the internal data around that complaint, and that's what then becomes a SAR. So, but you can get away with some complaints without creating a SAR.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've used Tippex. I've used Post-it notes, Rebecca, by the way.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, sorry, that threw me off then. I've lost it. Carry on.
Questions. Let's have a look at the questions then.
Yeah.
Through the thing. Another thing we've had this week is I don't know if we've got topical or not, but it's private devices and social media. So again, a request came in, and the requester wanted Teams chats, WhatsApp chats, and messages on some company devices and some non-company devices. Again, interesting scenario. Again, I don't know how people.
I don't know why they allow it. So a lot of our customers allow, you know, some type of chat within the business that allegedly is for, you know, internal chat about work. But clearly, obviously, what happens is that, you know, a team of people end up talking to each other about other things other than work. Like, you know, I had a bad day. What's going on? You're off ill. What's wrong? You know, and it turns it into, you know, where there's a lot of personal data. So we have to then include it. You know, I would advise anybody not to allow that to go on, you know, because they're not on device, they're on laptops.
Well, it's all right saying that, isn't it? Yeah, it's right saying that. You might have a policy saying, you know, you can't use WhatsApp for business purposes, communication purposes. Yeah. But if people do and you don't enforce that policy, I think it puts you in a weak position. So I don't think we were able to give the customer a definitive answer. It's pretty much, you know, well, no, it wasn't quite that. It was like, you know, the Teams is a business tool provided by the business for business communications. Therefore, for me, it's in scope. The company devices are in scope, control of those devices. If you have got a policy, but you don't enforce it, that you can't use WhatsApp for group communications, then, you know, on private devices, then to me, again, it's really nuanced. So if the discussion is related to the business or the business doing its business, pardon the expression, just realize what that said, then I would have thought that that would be within the scope. But if it's a social chat or a social group on a social comment, not really, you know, about the individual who made the request, but not within the context of the business doing its business, pardon the expression again, then I think that would be outside of the scope. So you can't just take hoover up everyone's devices and say, you know, we need to check these out because you might have been talking about this individual. If it's if it's within the context of the business, then it's in scope. And if it's outside the context of business, it's out of scope.
I might cause an argument between the two of you here, but where do you draw the line on business as usual information in that context?
Don't even ask, Phil, because we will definitely fall out of it.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. I have no idea what you're referring to. But we'll come on to that. But that, again, I'm not saying this is...
We've only got 6 minutes left. I don't know
best the right interpretation. But again, we spent a lot of time as a team ploughing through it, thinking it through, and, you know, working it out. What is going on with this WhatsApp situation, and SMSs as well. And that, you know, that we basically said, you know, if you've got a policy, you've got to build yourself a defensible position. You're either going to refuse it, you know, to look at these devices, or you're going to say they're in scope, or you're going to do something in the middle. But you need to build yourself a justifiable defensive position. And technically, how would we do it? As well, I would ask people to have a look, see if they've got any personal data, you know, of that individual on their personal devices, and if so, forward it to IT. You know, you might not get anything back, or you might. I'm going to leave that one hanging.
Sorry, I'm reading the chat as you're talking. Sue said, when setting up my search and retrieve process, I always have a folder labeled smoking gun. Rarely gets used.
So what do you mean by business as usual data, Jasmine?
I guess it might be information, say you've got a tenant and they need, I guess, a repair or something like that. And it might relate to fulfilling, you know, what you would normally do in your business activities as a housing sector, housing association. Where do you draw the line between it being the tenant's personal data or just, you know, fulfilling your responsibilities as the housing association or landlord?
Shall I make a start, Phil, or do you want to jump in?
No, I'm going to sit back and
I think a tenant one is more trickier because, for example, you know, usually in the header there'll be the tenant's address, which is personal data. You know, there may be a conversation, for example, a works order might have been created, you know, to raise work to be done on the house, whatever, and you know, you would class that as an internal order to get work done. But if that works order complains his address and, you know, information about repair that's on his home, arguably that is personal data. Some people say that's BAU. So, you know, these type of issues are really borderline. What is clearer is when, for example, you've got a finance manager or somebody who's putting a star and is telling everybody that, you know, this week's forecast and this week's accounts, you know, are attached, or can so-and-so fill in their forecast. You know, all that sort of stuff is definitely BAU. It's not personal data. They're actually talking about the role that they do.
It's got to relate, hasn't it?
Yes.
The information has got to relate to the data subject. And going back to Duran, you know, it's got to have biographical significance and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, if you read the guidance says that, you know, a mechanic doing repairs on a car, you know, the information about that report on the car is relate to the mechanic. Therefore, you know, I think that you know, potentially a works order will probably relate to the individual. But again, the context is key. So, you know, why is the bathroom getting replaced again? Because a person keeps smashing it up. Well, that's, you know, got some connotations to it. So that's what I love about working in this branch of the law, is it's really, really grey and subjective.
The famous phrase is, it depends, isn't it? So
yeah
I mean, a lot of the arguments we get, you know, that sometimes our customers think that, for example, you know, an electrical report or a works order or a certificate of electrical installation, you know, is not personal.
The only person later in that will be the identifying the requester, but the actual document itself, the data, the interesting stuff, doesn't relate to them, relate to the property in the main, although there might be exceptions.
Yeah, well, that was short and sweet for us.
Yeah,
too.
It's quite civilized.
I think we've learned to agree over the years.
Yeah you know best anyway. I don't know which one knows best, probably Phil.
I've got a ton of questions here, but we're not going to have any time to cover them off, unfortunately.
Well, maybe we should do an actual question and answers one, rather just discuss sound.
I mean, one of the key things is how you keep your team fresh. You know, you're looking at this stuff, you know, and some of it's quite harrowing, and you know, it's quite monotonous, isn't it? You got to be a particular type of person, you know, like me, you know, to actually enjoy. Oh, I wonder what the next paragraph's like. Oh, I wonder what the next paragraph's like.
You don't enjoy sales at all.
I quite do, actually. I shouldn't have said that, because you give me some stuff to do. But
yeah,
I quite do, because I'm a bit, you know, I'm a bit, you know, attention to detail type of stuff. So, I mean, it's other people get, you know, and it affects everyone, get fatigued. You know what my memory's like. I'll treat something on one page one way, and then the next page I'll treat it in a different way. Yeah. I mean, how do you keep that consistency?
Well, I think the secret for us is to try and make sure that people get, you know, obviously more training. So, you know, that's why we'll be doing a full day's training again. We often get together on our group chat and talk about a particular piece of information to give them guidance, you know, and I often say, why are you still on at this time? Get yourself off, have a break. You know, and we try and do the best job for the data subject. So not just for our client, we tend to try and make sure that the data subject gets what they're entitled to. And that's whether our client likes it or not. You know, we will advise the client, you know, we think you should, you know, disclose this. I know it's going to be tricky, but, you know, that's the law.
Yeah.
So we do try and do a good job for both client and the data subject, because, you know, we're abiding by the law.
Yeah, Mrs. Lane's interesting. Kind of, okay, so stop sitting on the fence. Would you release that report or not? Again, some of our customers will say to us, right, I'm going to try and bury them in paperwork, so give them everything. Redact the whole lot, just leave their name on top of it, and absolutely give them, you know, thousands of pages, because they're not going to find what they're really looking for in there. And others will say, we want to take the opposite approach, and we'll give as little away as possible. Personally, I would have to have a look at the electrical report and decide if I thought it related to the date subject in any way. And if it did, I'd release it. And if it didn't, I wouldn't. But again, the trouble with sitting remotely looking at this stuff is, if you're not involved in the context of it, sometimes it's hard to make the right call, isn't it?
Yeah. In addition to that, there's got to be a level of reasonableness as well. So is it reasonable to disclose it? You know, you can, I think, the guidance is that, you know, within filtering out the personal data, there'll be other information that isn't personal data, but it might not relate to somebody else. It might not be sensitive information. So there isn't, as Adrian says, what's the harm in disclosing it within reason?
Well, that's an unknown quantity, isn't it? So you just don't know what else is down the track.
There's a lot of factors.
If it it's not personal data, it's not covered by the GDPR. Therefore, you know, why would we release it? Some people would say, well, because it's such a pain in the neck to try and redact it, we just, you know, can't do any harm, we'll just release it. But horses for courses, I think.
Yeah. Well, should we wrap it up?
Oh, I've got loads of questions. We'll have to do another session, Jasmine. See, you're talking too much.
Pardon me. Trying to get a word in. No, I'm only joking, halfly. Anyway, thank you everyone for this session. Your comments and input has been really appreciated. Sorry that we couldn't go through all of them. And yeah, we will see you next week. I think it's another session for GDPR Radio, isn't it? So, and thank you, Kathy, our special guest.
Star Queen.
Yeah, Star Queen.
Well, hopefully we'll have another Star Queen. It won't be me.
thank you, Jasmine, very much for hosting. Yeah, thanks everyone for joining us. I hope that was interesting. Thanks for your contributions. Have a brilliant weekend, and we look forward to catching up with you next week.
Thank you. See you later.
See you later. Bye. Thank you.